Good afternoon, good morning, good evening. Welcome to the Controversial Exchange. Today, Danielle, who's been previously in the shadows, working hard on our show notes, continuously making sure you all can find your references and whatnot, is jumping on as a third co-host. Super excited. Gonna meet her, listen to a nerdy philosophical discussion that both her and Dimitri had. I will preface this with this is hopefully a little bit of a facelift for the podcast, and we have a ton of content coming. I believe there's 10 episodes in the hopper. So actually we're going to release more frequently than we used to kind of catch up, and then routinely on Sundays. Last announcement, we're working for anyone that's a behavior analyst out there, a board certified behavior analyst, on offering continuing education for people that listen to this and our past episodes. More to that to come in the next couple weeks, but just know, not only can you listen to this, learn, engage, have fun, but soon you'll be able to earn some continuing education. All right, for those on YouTube, this is audio only, and I hope you enjoy.
No, that sounds right now.
Yeah, that works. I like it.
Okay.
New intro.
And we've
started. Copyright issues there.
Hey, not if you hum it, I think. It only counts if you actually legitimately do that.
Besides,
Final Countdown, isn't that like at this point like publicly available?
Who's going to be listening to this really niche behavior analytic podcast?
That's true.
Without CEUs?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that Europe... The band has a lot of people on this. They're pretty prolific. But anyway, I guess this is the beginning of version 2.0, the Controversial Exchange.
Version 2.0?
Welcome. Yeah, this is 2.0. The original version was me and Ryan getting super mad about stuff over the microphone and slowly devolving into a bitter mess. And then version 2.0 is having you and me and then Ryan talk about fun shit while trying to keep it light and a little less angry all the time. I can't stand the rage. It's too much for me.
It was entertaining. It was an entertaining bitter mess.
I know, but that's the thing. Like, when people like for you to get that mad, like, it's like not good.
True story.
Like, yes, you got to protect yourself a little bit. You got to protect those feelings.
They're
real
and
they matter. But anyway, welcome Danielle Watson, the third amigo to our growing movement, the Controversial Exchange. You're my fellow graduate student.
Yes.
Let's see, what is there to say? I mean, Ryan kind of did an introduction about you, but I think that was only for patrons on the Daily BA. So do you want to introduce yourself briefly real quick?
There's not too much to introduce. I'm just doing the doctoral program. Should be done in hopefully about a year and a half, although still not entirely sure which direction I'm going with that. I'm just a little lonely BCBA on Vancouver Island in BC, looking to network and expand out and learn and grow and all that fun stuff. I'm still kind of a new BCBA compared to you guys, but... It's definitely been a growing and learning curve to be involved in the podcast and the graduate program and get a lot more information and kind of deeper into the nitty gritty of the field.
Well, if anyone's wondering how you got here, you are the one who's been doing our amazing show notes the whole time, which is like a level of attention to detail that Ryan and I both are pretty much ADHD incapable of accomplishing. So it's pretty amazing that you were willing to do that tedious work.
Oh yeah.
And be the nameless, faceless person in the background making us look good. So now you're stepping out in the forefront.
Yeah, I met Ryan back at ChatCon 2018 in Seattle and was just so nervous to meet him and was like, I would help out in any way possible. And I didn't know at all that this podcast was in the works. And so it just really, the stars really aligned that way.
So today we're going to talk about, I guess one of the things that's going to be happening is, I guess we'll just pick apart stuff that you and I are kind of doing at school sometimes just for funsies so that people can get a behind the scenes look at, some more in-depth, advanced, random discussions that people have about topics. And, recently, well, I guess before we do that, where were you at? You were in Georgia because you just went to a conference, right?
Auburn, Washington for WABA.
Oh, okay. How was that?
It was really good. It was Dr. Pat Miranda did a talk on aided language modeling. Greg Hanley did a talk on his PFA stuff. And then Dr. Kazemi did a talk on supervision and kind of building rapport with supervisees and then teaching them to build rapport with their clients and their supervisees and kind of this chain of rapport building that would lead to behavior analysis saving the world. It was pretty energetic and exciting.
What was her take on rapport building?
Yeah,
like what is that like? Like make friends and hold hands and talk about unicorns and.
Yeah, some of it was. Let me pull up my notes quick and have a quick little revision here because it was a lot of information in a very short amount of time.
I just feel like I'm skeptical whenever I hear those kind of talks because usually I feel like. Again, this is not to criticize anybody, but just from my personal experience, it seems that I always walk away from those feeling like, man, I really wish that that was more rooted in reality and took into consideration the pressure and the horrible limited resources and just grind that we experience in the applied setting and rather the super idealized version of stuff.
Well, and it kind of stemmed like, and we've talked about this a lot in our program, but around like how behavior analysis doesn't always have the most positive reputation around different pieces in our science and specifically in the developmental disability and autism realm. And so I guess her big take was if we can train supervisees to build rapport and collaborate with other professionals, then that will help with the dissemination of how this science has grown and become way more ethical and way more socially significant and is applicable to a lot of other areas, but we can't just push our way into these other domains. We need to build relationships and be open to utilizing different methodologies and different points of view. And that can be hard for us because of exactly what you're saying. So
do you agree with that?
Pardon? Do I agree with it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's tough. I haven't fully decided which side of the argument I lie in yet. I think it just depends on the situation, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that gets hard. For me, it's like, I'm cool until we get into pseudoscience land.
Yeah.
And then it's like, how can you possibly just have a conversation with somebody in that situation and take them seriously?
I don't know. I think forgotten a lot is the social validity aspect of our field, and specifically if we're talking about treatment with autism and developmental disabilities, sometimes parents are really gung-ho to try this stuff and you can do everything in your power to try to change their mind and it's not going to happen. And so do you remove yourself from that situation or do you find ways to adapt and collect data on that to show them that this is not working or find ways to collaborate? I mean, I don't know. It's kind of a cruddy situation.
Hmm. Yeah, that's like a whole episode in and of itself.
True.
I would love – that's I did an episode recently with someone named Lainey Lawson. She's an education she's an educational consultant, BCBA, and a super cool person, super smart. That was kind of her point of view. Like just flip it into a behavioral thing. You don't have to argue with them. And
like, as long as it's argument. Not dangerous.
Yeah, I know, but like, isn't, oh man, this is where I want to be principled, you know, like I want to be like Carl Sagan and take a stance for science and be like, no, fuck that shit.
Right.
Vaccines don't cause
but
autism.
Like, parents,
you're
don't,
wrong.
People don't like data. The general public doesn't like data. And if a parent, it's kind of like the least restrictive policies. Like you do everything in your power to convince them that this is not the right choice. But in the end, it's really their choice. And so then you have to decide, do I continue providing services or do I not? And where's the benefit in like the pros and cons in each?
Yeah, that's, I get that. I'm with that. That's true.
I don't know if you can press those principles into every parent or if they even care. Some of them.
I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. And I'm not arguing to press it into them. I'm more like just saying from a personal point of view, like, I guess maybe more like how firm do you hold steady and just in making sure that you're like your objection is noted valid, like, I don't know how to put it, strongly. I don't know.
Well, and like Hanley says, like you need to be able to defend your stance and your decisions and why you've chosen to do whatever it is you've chosen to do.
Oh, Greg Hanley.
I know.
Greg Hanley.
So wise.
True wisdom. He's too good for the podcast, though. No, he's not. That's all right.
And that this just kind of brings back a little bit of my background and like how the funding model in Canada and even the different provinces in Canada is just so different, and that we don't always have the resources available to work on something like that. I mean,
yeah, you're
like,
funny.
I don't understand the U.S. system super well, but I know it's different, that there are opportunities to get sometimes more resources than could ever be even fathomed up here.
Yeah, your funny model is totally whacked out. Yeah, why don't you, real quick, just to give the Canadian perspective, because I also think that is a valid, just like a very interesting thing to give the listeners so that they have some more context. Why don't you describe the funding model a little bit? Because I think that the insurance / Medicaid / educational access to funds / like blended funding resources that we have in the States compared to Canada is actually, despite it being a huge pain in the ass, is an embarrassment of riches in comparison. And I think it would provide some good insight to people to not necessarily be as frustrated or bitter with the way our system's set up. So why don't you give us a quick rundown of that real quick?
Okay, I am not the expert in this, and so if there are any listeners that want to correct anything or add something from the other provinces, because I'm really only familiar with the British Columbian model, and even then, my experience with it is limited to just kind of autism treatment on the island and not on the mainland or in the other rural areas of BC. But in BC, when you get an autism diagnosis, you parents are able to access funding from the provincial government. And if you're a child under the age of 6, parents can access up to $22,000 a year for behavior consultation, behavior intervention, speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, different services like that. And then when you turn 6, your funding is cut from $22,000 a year to $6,000 a year, theoretically, because you're then entering the public education system. And so some of the services that you would typically get privately, you could then get in the schools.
And are you allowed in schools up there?
Sometimes.
Yowza.
Some districts hire BCBAs, but it's still pretty new up here. And then some districts are more open to collaboration with outside professionals than others. It's really about parent advocacy and building rapport with the schools.
Oh, that sounds,
and that's, yeah.
That sounds pretty much the same as here then, as far as that goes.
That's what I've heard, yeah.
Okay. So what are we going to talk about today? What are we doing?
I think we should talk about this throwdown between William Baum and
Jay Moore.
Yeah. About radical behaviorism.
Let's do it.
Because I thought that was a really interesting component in one of our classes recently, and I didn't feel like we really got to dive into it that much in the course.
Okay, so for the listener, let's give them some reading material here. We got a book, 2008, Conceptual Foundations of Radical Behaviorism, written by a guy named Jay Moore. It's basically a radical behaviorist philosophy book. And then you have three different articles. William Baum, P.S., also wrote a philosophy book. I didn't know this. Published in 2015 that I just picked up. I haven't perused it yet. So his is a more recent book on the same thread of topics. I think he actually covers some more broader things in his. But anyway, and does a little bit more modern conceptions and has some functional contextualism in there. But anyway, and then we're going to be talking about three articles. One by William Baum, criticizing this book, and then a response by Moore, and then another rejoinder from our boy, William Baum. And, let's just see where this majestic thing takes us. So where do you want to start? Which one do you want to go? You want to just start with like,
can I just say that when I was reading these, I was imagining like the most cartoony throwdown of like researchers sitting at their desk typing vigorously at each other, almost like it was instant messaging on social media, even though I know it's through a scientific article, but I could just imagine them like typing and angry facing, and it was just, it's just very entertaining to read.
It's
not something you see
this is
in
so basically I guess I totally agree with you, by the way. This is basically, this is what I think what it looks like when professors engage in Facebook arguments, only they do it through the journals. Because it's the most it's the most passive aggressive shit I've ever seen in my life. And it's so funny. I can find
some quotes because there's some good ones.
Well, hold on. Let's lay down the argument. So Jay Moore wrote this book on philosophy and radical behaviorism. And this book is, in my opinion, really good. It covers every single topic you can imagine, only it covers it specifically from a very Skinnerian, hardcore, radical behaviorist perspective. So it's like, it's very like purist. It doesn't bring in functional contextualism. It doesn't bring in like inner behaviorism. Right? It doesn't bring in like other types of nuanced perspectives. It's very much like if Skinner were to be explaining this idea, be it private events, be it cultural contingencies, meta contingencies, macro contingencies, verbal behavior, whatever, challenges in psycholinguistics or other psychology, like it would all be from that point of view. And Baum basically read this book, I guess, and was like, no, bro, unacceptable. You did not bring enough diversity of thought into your description of these things. And if a person were to read them, they could get the false impression that this is what all radical behaviorism is. And he wrote a scathing rejoinder that was and I do think it was scathing, by the way. Like, it was pretty pretty ruthless.
The review? Yeah.
He called it.
It was
he called it Moore's screed. Yeah. Oh, man. It's in the first paragraph. In response to my review of his book, Moore has written a screed. I will call it Moore's screed. Oh, yeah. Man. Just like, ooh. And he just, what part of incomplete? Oh, so hold on. This sentence is the best. This is why I want to read this, because it's just like so ruthless. His description of the science omits almost all the advances that occurred since 1960 to the present. Research and choice, behavioral economics, adjunctive behavior, and so on. His treatment of radical behaviorism omits almost all of the writings of behaviorists since Skinner. What part of incomplete does Moore fail to grasp? I mean, this is in the Journal of Experiments. This is in JOB, dude. Like, I mean, the thing is that I feel like we got shit on the podcast for being so controversial, quote unquote, and saying ruthless things and like being hyper confrontational. But I want to know how that's different than this. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, I think the argument was that like we need to have these conversations about science in order to advance the science. And that's fair. But like there was some entertaining bicker back and forth. Oh my God. That's for sure. So and wonderful. You know what though, back to the point that Baum was actually making, I don't disagree with him.
So so Baum, what was the rest of Baum's critique? What, you want to lay out some of that for people?
More specific to like the definitions that Moore was using in relation to what verbal behavior was and how it differed from what Baum interpreted Skinner's definition to be. Like, they get into the argument around like animal language and if that could be considered verbal behavior versus human verbal behavior and having one listener versus multiple listeners.
I mean, that is just such esoteric shit though. Like, I mean, what do you think about the straight Skinnerian definition of verbal behavior? Well, I guess what let's.
Well, it's from Skinner's time.
Okay, like, so it is what? Let's say it's anything that any behavior that involves listener and speaker behavior, shaped by a larger verbal community. Is that a fair?
Yep, I would agree with that. And from that perspective, then because you yourself can be the speaker and the listener at the same time, then it's aligned with Moore's definition of verbal behavior.
And also of private events, too. Because a lot of the controversy has to do with what he did to describe private events. I mean, I guess my thing is that, like, I don't see what the big deal... Like, I feel like when you write... First of all, this book came out in 2008. So, like, most of the people who have got a boner about a lot of the verbal behavior stuff, mostly coming from an RFT perspective, and a lot of that writing didn't really get the research, I would say, not writing, but research really didn't get rolling till the mid 2000s. And I mean, if it came out in 2008, it was probably sent in for editing 2 to 3, 4 years before that, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, like, I don't know, like, it seems kind of like intentionally nitpicky and disingenuous to hardcore criticize him. And like the book to me seems to be like an introductory advanced. Like this is like introductory, but for graduate students. Like it's not supposed to be some hardcore esoteric examination of all these ideas and topics for people. Like that's not the point.
Mind you, though, I looked into this after our class to see if there was something more recent or more in depth about radical behaviorism. And I came up short. I could not find a more recent text that was advanced enough for a graduate program on radical behaviorism.
Oh, I'll have to look that.
Please, listeners, send me some if you know of any. But
I wonder if that Baum one is, because he wrote Baum, then wrote one like 3 or 4 years
ago. But I think Moore acknowledges that. Well, which so he does acknowledge it, but these articles are from 2011, so it's possible.
That's true. That's also fair. That's great. So they go, they basically fight back and forth like it's straight up fucking Facebook warfare. Why private events are a mistake. Oh my God. They're just so ruthless with each other.
And Baum goes into like, if private events are truly private, then they're never going to be measurable. And really, we still use an introspective type way of examining private events, like self-reports. And if we do that, he's basically saying we're no better than cognitive theorists or psychologists. And also, when you do the introspection method, then that data actually now becomes public. So are we still looking at public verbal behavior, or are we looking at private verbal behavior? And he kind of gets into that a little bit. Ooh. Like once it's out of the mind, it's no longer private.
But it's not in the mind. What do you think about that argument? You agree with it?
I mean, he's kind of right in that you're looking at two different behaviors, right? Like there's your true private behavior that no one else is observing except for yourself. Right. And then there's your self-reported public verbal behavior on your private behavior. And those are kind of different.
Yeah, but he's engaging in a bullshit philosophical argument. This is like a Nietzschean argument. Like if a tree falls in the woods and no one's there to see it, did it actually fall? The answer is fucking yes. Like,
and I guess the other piece is like, even though introspection is overly reliable, we don't really have a lot of other options right now. He even, and like they all say this in the articles, everybody acknowledges that we have private events, that we are able to imagine that we do have thoughts. So it's not an argument of whether those exist or not. It's just an argument of whether or not we need to be researching it or measuring it.
Well, yeah, thoughts in terms of like covert verbal behavior, yeah. Right? But yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess. I mean, a lot of people want to do that though. Oh, that's the hot shit. That's ACT.
Well, RFT. And I think we need to do it to extend the science, because if we don't, and what are we going to do? Just wait around for some technology to come about that can magically read our thoughts and spit them out?
I don't know.
I
guess that's what Skinner would have said. I mean, Skinner wrote, he would always cop out to the absence of enough technology. He would, like, there's a, in Science and Human Behavior, he refers to the technologists of the future. In Technology of Teaching? No. Or in one of those, or maybe it was about behaviorism. One of them, he refers to the physiologist of the future. I don't know. There's a lot of different times where he just defaults to we just don't have the sophisticated enough technology. Oh, there's also there's an interview on YouTube that you can watch of him where he talks about education and talks about feelings and emotions, and he refers to the fact that there's unsophisticated instruments that will hopefully come into place in time. Yeah, I don't know, man. I'm just I just feel like the whole argument about private events is, I think it's meaningful only in terms of how you can use it. Like, ultimately, we're pragmatists, right? We should be pragmatists. If it works, if it's useful, if it's a reasonable argument, given if it's the best possible argument available with the best possible evidence available, that should be our default position until the next set of evidence and the next best argument comes about. That's the general accepted definition of pragmatism. So, I mean, like, if the best explanation of private events that we have is the engaging of covert listener speaker behavior, where one acts as their own listener and their own speaker, basically mirroring an overt definition of verbal behavior, then that should be acceptable. Now, whether or not you can study it or not, yeah, I mean, that gets into arguments about like whether or not self-reports are reliable, which we know that they're not, et cetera. But I don't know. I guess, again, like that makes me think of again, a pragmatic point of view, and this is not usually the position that I'll take just because I usually take the devil advocate's position, but it makes me think of, like, if it's working, who gives a shit, right? Because there's so many people who I mean, I'm one of them. I criticize ACT all the time, and I criticize a lot of the not quite the cognitive-ish kind of interventions that are out there. But, I mean, a lot of people get – it works for them, right? And I – so if a placebo works, work. Fuck it.
There's research – I mean, deductive research and individualized research showing that people have improvements. And whether that's, again, based on self-reporting, but even if it is just self-reports, back to the social validity aspect, if someone believes that they are feeling better, then I feel like I they've done their job.
Yeah, the take it. Take the win. Take the W. Take the W. Again, I don't think that's enough, exactly. though, to construct a philosophical but like position. Yeah, you should not hang not your philosophical hat on that. But in the applied setting, I think that you walk away with that. And I think you just say that, okay, we need to do a lot more experimental research to come up with a better first principle that explains this phenomena, this naturalistic phenomena, better and more clearly for the world, so that we can actually call it, you know, a first scientific principle. You know, like, what is the gravity? What is the gravity? What is the 9.8 meters per second of covert behavior type scenario? You know what I mean? So that's great. Yeah, more.
I just found Baum's textbook. He wrote it in 2005 called Understanding you said Behavior.
He wrote another one about culture. Yeah, he wrote another one about culture, 2015. Okay. That's the one I was referring to, which actually has a lot of philosophy in it.
Okay.
So we should – did you see – so let's – so okay, we talked about what – so Moore's response, he gave – you know, this is the thing. So – okay, so for the world out there, so like Noam Chomsky wrote this huge critique of verbal behavior, right, forever ago, and it was kind of a big deal, and it was considered widely as a it's kind of a big deal.
It was kind of
and
a
considered
big deal.
Widely a massive takedown of Skinner, and Skinner never responded, which in my which is like not to give it like a streets narrative, but like on the streets, Skinner kind of got bitched out. Anyway, he should have definitely taken a stance.
But Skinner didn't respond, but he kind of made comments about it. Like, he commented on the fact that he didn't respond, which to me is sort of a response in its own. He was like, I didn't respond because I didn't feel the need to respond because this guy clearly didn't understand what I was talking about.
Yeah, I mean, that's cool. I mean, I understand pacifism, but I mean, like, if someone brings a gun and you turn your back and they shoot you in the head, you lost, whether or not you were morally righteous or not. So this, let's read. So the one comment that he did make here, Moore quotes it because I think Moore was passive. Well, no, he actually was very aggressively. This is not passive at all. Was talking shit back. And he goes, in his review, Baum argued that my conceptual foundations is incomplete, distorted, and woefully out of date among other milder descriptors. I am reminded of Skinner's comments about Chomsky. And I never heard this. I have never been able to understand. So this is Skinner talking about Chomsky. I have never been able to understand why Chomsky becomes almost pathologically angry when writing about me. But I do not see why I should submit myself to such verbal treatment. If I thought I could learn something which might lead to useful revisions of my position, I would, of course, be willing to take my punishment. But Chomsky simply does not understand what I am talking about, and I see no reason to listen to him, as reported by some guy in 1991 in this Moore paper. So basically, his argument is sticks and stones can break my bones, but go fuck yourself. So, like, okay. I mean, that's a great, hilarious thing to say. But I still think that just in defense of behaviorism, he should have done that. And in thinking about...
Well, he does that throughout his whole article. Like, even in the next paragraph, he's like, I really don't think that the journal should have even accepted Baum's review, and it wasn't relevant at all, and it should have been rejected. And,
yeah.
But at least they're letting me write back and defend myself. But then he doesn't really acknowledge any of the criticism.
Dude, so it's very unusual. Like, I usually don't have to look up words, but he said, despite Baum's concerns, the book was not written as Skinner's hagiography. I had to look up that word. It's his bibliography of a saint. It's called a hagiography. So, oh my God, man. Like,
but it was very Skinner based, and Moore clearly has a very strong understanding of Skinner and is very fluent in Skinner's material, because throughout this whole reply to Baum, he drops Skinner quotes everywhere.
Why do you think this kind of fighting doesn't happen all the time? I feel like very rarely. The reason we're talking about this is because, like, we've been looking for a lot of rejoinders or looking at, like, people going talking shit in the journals, and it's super hard to find them, mostly because they're scattered across so many years. Why do you think this doesn't happen all the time? I feel like this is healthy. Like, I like this.
Because of this? Because of what we're doing? Because this is probably not the perception that they intended to give.
What, joy?
Well, they probably... I don't even know, like, I have to admit, I don't really know who William Baum and Jay Moore are outside of these things that I've read. I know that William Baum is very involved in Squab and has been in the field for a very long time and has done a lot of research. Same with Jay Moore. But, like, I don't really know them.
I mean,
right?
None of us do.
And so what if they're actually, like, good buddies and they can go to the bar together? And this stuff is just... to write in the journals just to get citations and
Man, you think it's kayfabe?
Like
you think it's kayfabe? This is what. Let's introduce the concept of kayfabe, shall we? So in fake wrestling, they get the microphones and like they talk shit to each other and it's just like, you know, just a lot of theatrics and nonsense and like provocateuring and stuff. That's a specific technique called kayfabe, where it's intentionally designed to entice and like provoke the other person and the audience into this visceral response of rage with them. So you think this could just be just kayfabe, just talking shit for the sake of it so that people can like do what we're doing now, which is joyfully and gleefully enjoy the mudslinging.
It is so much more entertaining to read.
I know. This is what I'm...
than to just read some basic criticisms on radical.
I wish all of it was like this. You know what I wish? You know who I wish would do this? You know what I'm going to say, right?
I could take a guess.
Of course you know who I'm going to say. Who do you think I wish would do this? And I hope he listens.
I hope he listens
to this podcast, cuz this is about respect. I wish Hanley would do this like on the real.
I wish
he would do this with some of that new bullshit that's come out from Greer and Fisher and all these guys writing these nonsense articles about synthesized contingencies and stuff. Like,
we very briefly talked about it at the conference, not him and I necessarily, but like it was brought up at the conference, and it's really just comparing apples to oranges. Like, you're not even looking at the same thing.
Dude, I don't understand how you could turn the other cheek. Like, it's such an obvious, egregious manipulation of one's position for publication and just like disingenuous argumentation. That's
I would argue though that he's not turning the other cheek. I would argue that his way of fighting that is through his dissemination in workshops, because I feel like people come out of those feeling so refreshed and so invigorated, and then they go out and disseminate to their colleagues and peers, and then it kind of sets off this chain reaction.
I hate it that you try to make such reasonable, measured arguments against me. It's so frustrating. Okay.
You said you wanted this podcast to be
lighter.
I know,
I do. But I mean, like...
just doing my job.
That's true. You are. That's true. This is what you were hired to do. That's a fact. Which you get paid in friendship and appreciation. But I mean, like... I don't know. This whole, like, if when they go low, we go high bullshit routine is how you lose. I feel like when people go low, you kick them in the nuts. Like,
do you think that the people who are criticizing the PFA, do you think that they actually don't understand the procedure? Or do you think that they're just trying to do the same thing that we're arguing these guys were trying to do and just to, like, push the science
forward?
Are they,
like, playing kayfabe? I would be speculating on their intent, of course. I mean, in my mind, when I'm reading it, first of all, I'm generally suspect of people, and I'm automatically kind of that way. I'm not that it's paranoid, but just like I assume bad intentions in most of these situations.
Oh, that's funny. I'm the complete opposite. I've been told I'm too naive. I'm like, everybody's so nice.
I know. So like that's why this works. But I mean, like, so I assume that they're doing it to be ridiculous. And I assume that it's self-serving and it's to preserve, you know, a legacy and a publication legacy and that kind of thing. But I mean, like, it's possible that they just don't understand the procedure. I mean, because the other option, the other way to describe it is that it's people who haven't actually practiced how to use functional analysis and then what the results of it would be in real life. So like why the standard functional analysis is total shit in real life and in practice. And, you know, reasonable people can disagree on that. But I mean, like, okay, that's your opinion, man. Like, cool. And you must have infinite money in a super cool clinical experimental setting because the rest of us are operating on some pretty limited resources. So I don't know. Like, I guess in the best moments, I feel like maybe it's just that. They're just trying to protect the legacy and think they're doing the right by trying to keep this reductionistic, you know, mindset and hold on what it means to be a scientist doing applied behavior work. But I mean, on the other side of that, though, I do think also that there's no way that you make – it's just so hard for me to wrap my brain around such smart people making such egregious category mistakes and building straw men in their arguments. Like, those are two pretty obvious classic – logical errors in discourse that high-level academicians should not be committing when they're constructing their methods and when they're constructing the argument or the narrative they're trying to sell after before they start doing whatever research they're doing. Like, they should already have planned for that kind of a confound so that they wouldn't get accused of that. So that's – but again, maybe I'm just, you know, being hypocritical, but that just seems to be a position that I think is a reasonable assumption to go into it with. So yeah, I don't know, man. I don't buy good intentions there, and I also don't buy like blind naivete. I don't buy it.
Yeah, that's fair. That's another thing that I appreciate about Hanley, though, is that he acknowledges the historical aspect and importance of functional analysis and the way that it paved the way for these newer procedures to come out.
So anyway.
And also, we just need to give credit to people who have also worked on this that are outside of Hanley. Because I always think about that. He gets, like, the most publicity around it. But there's so many people who have done research in this area.
Can you name any of them? Can you name anyone that you think were
so involved?
Who would you name that you think deserves credit that doesn't get any?
He named a bunch of people. He named Tessel, someone. Jessel, I think. Or Jessel.
Jessel.
Oh no!
Yeah, Jessel, Majid Gamenagami. She's the shit. I would love to meet her. Her FCT work is the shit.
Keep going. Keep name dropping.
I don't know. That's pretty much the two that I would say are the two that I know.
Okay.
Those are the two that I've mostly published of the stuff that I've read. And Tiger, she's done work with him, I think.
That name sounds familiar to me.
Yeah, that's a critique of...
Anyways, I just wanted to acknowledge that there's like a whole group of people that do the research outside of just...
Yeah, I know, but he's the face of it. Yeah, he's the face of it. So, I mean, like... Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, when you watch the Justice League, you're watching for Superman. I mean, Batman's cool, but only real, real hardcore fanboys give a fuck about that.
That's...
Back to Moore, though. Oh, my God. Wow, we really got off topic there. Yeah, I don't know. So
part of his argument back is he like dives deeper into certain concepts. Like, he goes into talking about punishment and equivalence and reinforcement, and I don't really understand why.
Yeah, I think it's just because he gave such a conventional argument that he did not go into the deep, deep nuance. So he gives all like the critique from the nuanced perspective on all those topics. Cause I mean, like every single one of them is that. I really suggest people read the articles. What is Radical Behaviorism? A Review of J. Moore's Conceptual Foundations of Radical Behaviorism. That's JOB 2011. And then Moore's Rejoinder is also, I believe, 2011. Yeah. A Review of Baum's Review. Assistant to the regional manager. I mean, what the fuck? So, there's a couple. It's pretty funny. So they all happened in the same year. But yeah, it's pretty hilarious.
And then, like, Moore gets all huffy because, I shouldn't say huffy, but he gets upset, or it comes across as upset because I guess Baum was like, how come you didn't cite other people? And Moore's like, well, why would I cite myself and why should you cite yourself?
Oh, man, that's pretty legit. Dude, self-citation is a problem.
It is a problem.
Yeah. What do you, have you, there was an article republished in the last, like, I want to say 6 or 7 months. I can't remember what, it wasn't a behavior journal that was published in. I think it was more of a natural science one, like a physics or something like that, like maybe a science, where they did a statistical breakdown of people who are engaging in self-citation, and it's in the thousands, almost like 75% of mathematicians and physicists and chemists and medical professionals engage in self-citation to the point where, like, they inflate their numbers.
Well, when you think about how your article gains prestige based on the number of citations, why wouldn't people self-cite?
Yeah, I guess. I mean,
because no one's looking into who's citing, like, until now.
Yeah, I guess. Does that invalidate?
That impact.
So, I mean, just thinking about writing a paper. If I wrote a paper on a topic and I have to write a similar paper, say 2 years later, could I potentially just take my paper and self-cite it and rework it and technically not be cheating?
I think that would still be cheating.
I mean, but these guys get published doing it. Why can't I?
Well, they have to incorporate other things too. But I mean, and there's a difference between like replication of something new and you're the only person doing it.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Like Mark Dixon's stuff on Peak, he has to self-cite, like, or had to for a long time. Now he doesn't necessarily, but there was a lot of self-citing because he was the only guy doing research in Peak.
Yeah, well, because Peak is his own proprietary assessment tool. It's not like...
So there's some bias there, but...
That's not like... testing whether or not private events having a conversation on private events. That's like trying to prove your own product so you can sell it, dude, and call it evidence-based. That's a totally different thing.
I mean, if no one else is going to do it, and devil's advocate, like he worked it. He did group studies and individual studies, and he did different populations.
I mean, I'm not saying it's not legit. I am actually questioning the legitimacy a little bit. But I mean, like, that is what happened with Peak. That is what it is.
Yes. I mean, but now there are more people researching it and being able to confirm what he was doing, too.
Yeah, okay. I guess you needed to get it to pick up steam, right? It's like a little self-promotion didn't hurt nothing. Nobody. As long as it actually matters.
And, like, a lot of the PFA stuff are Hanley citations.
Yeah, that's true. Well, no, that's not true. Not initially. I mean, Hanley's on there as like second, third, fourth author on a variety of different other publications. Yeah. But the theory and all the different interventions they have basic material. It's like legitimate translational research, in my opinion.
It is, yeah. Like, no, you're
totally
right.
Legit translational research. I mean, like, most of it goes back to just functional communication in and of itself as a alternative to variety of problem behaviors, like a universal alternative to problem behavior. That goes back to like original studies, like Carr and Durand, like 1985, like old shit today.
Okay. Well, how old school do you want to get in self-citations? Because I'm sure Skinner had to cite himself when he was doing all of his stuff about,
you know, that's funny. Cause I was thinking about that the other day. Cause I was, what was I reading, man? I was going back and looking at this chapter in Science of Human Behavior. And, I thought about, you know, like you get smacked around sometimes where you write a whole paragraph and you just put one citation down and you're like, okay, this citation's
I never do that. I was taught by, and I'll give a shout out to Elliot Marchant at Vancouver Island University. He totally taught me. He was like, if you're not an expert, you cite everything that you say that is not your expertise or your opinion.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay. Well, I mean, like, the thing is, I came up as a philosopher, so I think of everything through deductive line of logic. So to me, it's more like logic doesn't belong to anybody. So if you have it, if you deduce something, you can't necessarily say that it was someone else's thing. But assuming you cite someone else's argument, you would run the argument down and then you would just cite at the end. And that's intended to be for everything. But if you get the nitpicky asshole, whatever, who wants to say this line belonged to this guy, this sentence belonged to this guy, this word in this sentence belonged to this guy, this other word belonged to this guy. So you have 17 citations for a 6-word sentence, even though it's like, well, the is kind of a general word, but okay. It seems a little bit ridiculous. It seems a little ridiculous. But I mean, like, if you look through a lot of it, like, there's not a lot of citation in that book, actually, in Science, Human Behavior. There's not a lot of citation in Verbal Behavior. I mean, there is a good amount of citation, but I mean, throughout the text, all the way when he's just like rambling or like thinking out loud as he's writing, there really isn't a lot of citation, obviously. So, I mean,
I guess he did a lot of conceptualization.
Yeah, so that's the point. My point is, if you're engaging in a conceptual exercise, do you have to really cite it? So, How do you cite a conceptual exercise if you're just like thinking creatively and just writing out loud, but doing it in a systematic way where you're trying to fit it within a framework? And should you have to describe that to someone?
You cite where you're deriving it from. Like, I'm sure he cited Darwin and stuff because some of his concepts came out of natural selection and whatnot.
I guess, man. I don't know. I don't think I remember seeing a Darwin 1876 anywhere. Or whatever year that book came out. could you imagine your contemporaries being that?
I mean, he would have had to have self-cite when he was developing the matching law and whatnot, too.
Yeah, okay. Do you imagine your contemporary being Charles Darwin? Like, talk about fucking trying to... I mean, like, God, that's a hard act to follow, man.
Now, okay, this is sort of off topic.
Go,
but
off topic.
You know, Darwin's a pretty big guy in his field, and Skinner's pretty big in our field. Who do you think's like the it person of our era for this science?
I mean, the easy answer is Steve Hayes. I don't know. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I mean that will be the answer one day.
He'll be talked about for...
I mean, because he's mainstream. Like, the reason that Skinner's talked about in general is because he was mainstream. I mean, arguably speaking, you know, Skinner's really not that influential in psychology today outside of behavior analysis. I mean, most behavior analysts...
Well, and that's where that talk from Dr. Kazemi came in, because the other sciences don't always like us.
Yeah. But I mean, like, so, like, Darwin is Darwin. So, like, Darwin is big no matter what discipline you're in. He transcends biology. You know, he transcends his discipline because he was transformative in the way that, I mean, he was almost a step in thought of our species. You know, like, human beings will think of existence differently forever, right? As a result of Darwinian theory.
Do you think that if Skinner was able to live a little longer or was born a little later, that he could have had that effect on our science too?
On our science, he did. On the world, I don't know. I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think he had... I don't think that... I think behavior analysis is too micro and conceptual to have the kind of necessary juice in it to feed that kind of... To like really bring about that level of inspiration and like a zeitgeist of lay people. And I know someone's...
He sure had that world vision, though.
Oh, he may have. Yeah, he definitely did. Definitely had the world vision. But I mean, like, he didn't, like, again, like, evolutionary theory went in the face of every... I mean, evolutionary theory is like the equivalent... It's like a Copernican revolution level event. You know what I mean? It countered scientifically and empirically religion. Same thing with heliocentricity. I mean, like, it countered, like, the religion
heliocentricity.
Yeah, that's what, like, this, like, the sun is the center of the universe rather than...
Oh, thank you.
Geocentrism.
Okay, thank you. I'm one of those flat earthers, don't you know?
Oh my God, those fucking flat earthers, man. We'll have to look up to see where their Facebook group is at. It's been a while. I'm scared to look. Who commented on flat earthers recently? I think I saw a thing. Anyway, Eddie Murphy was on TV and they were talking about Kyrie Irving as a flat earther. I don't understand that at all. Oh, and who else was doing that? I don't remember. It doesn't matter. This is fun. So are you having fun? What do you think? You think this is going to be a fun thing for you to do?
Yes, definitely. I don't know if I'm going to enjoy doing my show notes and listening to myself talk.
Oh, well, I mean, show notes are really one of those things that, I don't know, do people like them? That would be a good thing for the listeners to tell us. I'd like to hear more, like, if it's a lot of work. So, I mean, like, if it's a thing that people aren't going to really, But anyway, I would maybe and we can help.
I think it's helpful to have links to the different articles that are talked about.
Yeah, and that's good.
Links to the different people that get talked about.
Oh my God! All right, guys. So, 48 minutes in, and the Flat Earth Society is currently at 205,000 likes on Facebook. I believe the last time we checked, we were at 201,000. That's 4,000 more people since the last time we checked.
I can't believe it grows.
Dude, how about there's three different ones? There's the Flat Earth Society. There's Flat Earth Society Discussion Group, and then there's Flat Earth Society, the world famous Flat Earth Society, a place for free thinkers and intellectual exchange of ideas.
Oh, you should join.
That's their description. The world famous Flat Earth Society, a place for free thinkers and the intellectual exchange of ideas. Oh my God! I wonder if you get an aluminum foil hat for joining sent to you in the mail.
That's mean.
Oh shit. There's also the Flat Earth Believers. They have 64,000 likes.
And I mean, a lot of those people are going to be double likers, so you can't really add these all together.
That's true. I guess that's true. Oh my God, dude. We're all going to die.
Can we just jump back to the more
yes, go review back. Again? Yes, go back.
I just remembered a part that I thought was interesting. More considers himself a radical behaviorist.
Okay.
Moore accuses Baum of being a methodological behaviorist because of the talk on private thoughts and verbal behavior.
Fair.
But Baum never really states in any of his or in any articles that there were some other ones that I read written by him on this subject and verbal behavior. He never really says whether or not he's a radical behaviorist.
I mean, I think because that should go without being said. I think that's more of a shots fired scenario where he's like, bro, you're going to criticize the way I talk about private events and you're going to be dismissive of them and say we shouldn't study them just because we can't observe them. That's pretty methodological of you. You know what I mean? That's.
But because he uses his molar argument, I don't know.
No, say what you got to say. Say it.
Well, I think he denies being a methodological behaviorist. He just never says what his philosophy is that he follows. And I'm wondering if that sort of ties back to you and I. We talked about it a few weeks ago around like whether or not you and I considered ourselves to be radical behaviorists and if there were even really any other options.
I mean, I guess, do you consider yourself a radical behaviorist?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and then I was trying to look into like the difference between radical behaviorism and functional contextualism, and I was having a hard time seeing the like a big picture difference.
Yeah, that's a hard one. Functional contextualism has a lot more, in my opinion, of a subjectivist line to it than radical behaviorism does, right? Because radical behaviorism is just a declaration of covert and overt behavior being selected by consequences, right? Mm-hmm. And functional contextualism is about the relationship between those particular responses in the environment and the person experiencing them. So like they add more like a secondary link. Like it's kind of the difference between, oh man, this is going to be an analogy that no one's going to get because it's so fucking esoteric, but it's like the difference between like a more conventional philosopher or a logical positivist and like an existentialist who like a subjectivist, someone who looks at the world, who says that the world is different based on whatever position that you're observing it from. Does that make sense? So like basically like everybody's even though it's about truth, right? So even though there are basic facts that exist in the world, by sheer fact that I'm looking at it from a 45 degree angle based on my life experiences and you're looking at it from a 75 degree angle from your life experiences, we are technically experiencing those objective events differently, and therefore they mean different things to us and they are different in lieu of the relationship that they have to us. You see what I'm saying? That would be more in line with a functional contextualist position only put through a behavioral lens. So like where radical behaviorism is like it doesn't take that leap of the subjective point being mattering in the interpretation of events. It simply states you know, listener or covert over behavior, you know what I mean, selected by consequences. So that's really the difference, is taking the next step and adding that subjectivist point of view. It's just a, like, but I mean, like, so the question is, do you want to go that step further? And do you think that the functional difference or the distance between those events and between the different people potentially observing it or experiencing it, does that necessarily change it in and of itself? That would be the conversation, right? And I don't know if that's mm-hmm. the case. Like that, I've always struggled with subjectivism of that kind, because I don't think it changes a thing intrinsically. But again, it is still pragmatism, because pragmatism is just about having the best possible argument based on the best available facts. So subjectivism does fit within a pragmatic point of view. So it's both, it's still pragmatic, but is it necessarily behavioral, you know, or is it going a next step further? I don't know. Like, I get uncomfortable with that, because you start getting into questions about like, what is an objective fact, and what is the difference between capital T truth and, like, you know, lowercase truth, and who mm-hmm. defines those things? And you start getting real fucking out there, and you start asking questions that for me don't matter anymore. Like, I feel like that's shit for like when you're 22 and a stoner, like, you know, for grownups, should we be really worried about those things? I don't know. What?
I'm only 26. I'm not a stoner.
Okay, my bad, bro. I didn't mean to generalize. I'm just saying. Like, it just seems like asking those questions that are inherently don't have answers, even though they offer interesting conceptual exercises, and they do ask interesting questions. I mean, like, should we ask questions about what is the nature of truth and where is it derived and all those high level things? Yeah, sure. Of course we should. Someone should be asking those questions. But do I think in the context of a behaviorism, should we necessarily be diving into that in our everyday day? No, I don't think that has any value to your average person out there trying to practice science in real time. But then again, this is a critique of a behavior philosophy book. So I think in that circumstance, I think it's fair, but, yeah, I mean, going back to your question, what would I consider myself? I don't know, man. I think that radical behaviorist makes sense. I think that that's the farthest I'd be willing to go. I usually like to maintain mm-hmm. agnostic positions and not really take any of them. And just like in this instance, I would almost just say I'm a pragmatist. And right now, the pragmatic point of view is radical behaviorism, but I'm not necessarily married to it. But if you...
Are those mutually exclusive?
What do you mean?
Like, I'm not. So I'm still learning about these things.
Yeah, sure.
Like, you can be a pragmatist and a radical behaviorist?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yes. So it's like, think about it like categories. Like, pragmatism is about, like... how do you determine something to be valid, right?
Yeah.
And then radical behaviorism is the thing that I determined to be valid based on a pragmatic point of view.
Right. Gotcha.
And then contextualism would be the next thing. Like, based on a pragmatic point of view, I would hold that contextualism is valid, you know? mm-hmm. But I don't know. Like, I mean, if you want to take a holistic perspective, you know, functional contextualism makes sense, or just general contextualism makes sense. Like, and that's where you get into Steve Hayes, and that's what the whole thing with Steve Hayes, you know, doing the whole beyond or whatever, the whole like a post-Skinnerian account, like the whole idea was moving it just straight from this, you know, kind of reductionistic but like sterile point of view that doesn't take the individual experience into the equation of it, and kind of building in the subjectivist notions a little bit more concretely. But I don't know, like, again, I could be talking out of my ass and I could be corrected by someone. It's just my understanding of things.
Mm-hmm.
but yeah, it's, they ask big questions. They ask a lot of big questions, and I don't know what the right answer is. I think that,
and people are interested in it because of that. Like, it's blown up.
That's the thing. That's literally the point I was just going to make. Like, but that's also the thing that makes it dangerous, in my opinion. Like, the thing that's dangerous about adding to the definition the subjective or the glasses in which you view things based on your point of your perspective, I think that's dangerous for someone who for people who don't have a super nuanced understanding of what that means. you know, because mm-hmm. then it becomes what it's devolved in pop culture is that like, well, if it's just the way I see things, my opinion is valid because that's my experience. So, you know, there is no such thing as, you know, that's how you get into this post-truth reality, right? The way that we've gotten into a post-truth world is based on subjectivism. And subjectivism is being pushed in every single, it's been in every single discipline has been in some way, I'm going to use the word infected, but I don't mean it necessarily in a negative way. I just mean it in terms of like all of the primary philosophical foundational positions that most people take, that most disciplines have now have this kind of postmodernist skew to it and have this kind of like subjectivist angle to them. Which means that there is no, which kind of does push people to make statements like there's no such thing as objective truth. And therefore, any truth is true if it's true to you. So you get into this post-true world, truth world, right? And it's like, well, I mean, that conflicts with the empiricist in me. That conflicts with someone who wants to take like a scientific perspective and like be objective about stuff and not put their feelings and their own experience into it and cloud it that way. Because if you want to talk about bias, that's real bias. Real bias is mm-hmm. thinking that, and talk about egocentrism too, right? Oh my God, how narcissistic is it to say that like, just because it's your experience, that is necessarily the objective truth that everyone else should have to, in some way, shape or form, comply to. Like it's preposterous. Like that's where I start, those arguments start to bother me significantly because they make it very difficult to have a conversation without people getting personally offended and or without bringing in their own experiences into a conversation. And it becomes, how do you evaluate things that way? How do you fucking measure them? How do you analyze them? How do you critique them?
That
how do
you ties right stuff? Back to the articles. It was kind of hard to keep up with what they were actually talking about because I was so distracted by the personal attacks. Or what totally appeared to be personal attacks.
Yeah, I think that I can laugh at that part and then get back to the argument, but I'm with you on that.
But it does take away from the argument, for sure.
I know, Danielle. That's why we're doing the podcast this way now, okay? You win. You're right. What do you want from me? I'm just a person.
Doing
my best out here.
We have to wrap things up probably pretty quick, yeah. But just to tie it back to our coursework, were you surprised by how many people were advocates of something related to functional contextualism like acceptance and commitment therapy or
training.
Relational frame theory
training,
had
please.
Never read verbal behavior and had never really understood the foundations of radical behaviorism and kind of the history of that?
Did you just say that because you want me to get fucking triggered? Like what? Is that what this was? Of course. Of course I was blown away by it. Weren't you?
Well, I feel like I was sort of in that category because I had never read verbal behavior. I had always intended to, and I never presented myself as someone who knew lots about acceptance and commitment therapy, but I definitely had started researching it without really realizing how much deeper down the rabbit hole I could go.
Yeah, I think that goes, I mean, to give a shout out to Ryan in that Schlinger video and why that Schlinger video is so important and why Hank Schlinger, again, I don't actually agree with everything he said, but I think that his points are he's Paul Revere writing down saying the fucking British are coming. Like, I mean, he's sounding an alarm that I think is very serious. And I think it speaks to that and that like there is a discussion about the soul of what the field believes, right? And the more that we have these philosophical conversations and like where you stand on in certain areas and what lens in which you interpret certain facts, I mean, that is going to shade and color the way that you go out and disseminate and the way that you go out and do research and the way that the story of what is this ontogenic evolutionary or operant learning happens in the world, right? I mean, because like the stakes are so high, right? What is our science, right? Our science is micro evolutionary theory, right? It's the way organisms mm-hmm. change within their lifetimes. Okay, it's the answer to the question. Well, I never see evolution. Burf burf bishmurf and burf. You don't see evolution, dumbass, because that level of evolution requires millennia. It's a macro change, okay? The micro evolutionary steps you see are called operant learning, operant behavior. And let me show you how that works. They're both selected by consequences over time. Natural selection is selected by consequences, so is operant behavior. so, like, we're talking about fighting for the soul of microevolutionary theory. So, and bringing in a subjectivist account of that would definitely significantly alter the way that we would have that conversation and the way that that would impact just the narrative of human existence.
Already has altered the conversation because that's how cognitive psychology came to be so exactly. much larger than behavior analysis after Skinner's death.
Yo, exactly, bro. So, like, I don't know what to tell you there. Like, I think that we need to be able to have that conversation without people getting triggered and pissed off about it and, like, challenge that shit. Because it's dangerous. And it's, again, like, I sound like some crazy conservative theorist. Dangerous. These kids in their rock and roll music. But I mean, like, fucking for real, dude. Like, it's dangerous conceptually because, like, it is such thing as going backward by getting too out there. Like, you want to make sure that if you're going to make alterations to the viewpoint that you have the evidence and you have the proof to support your position. And that's not the case currently. You know.
Well, it's still important to disseminate the information, but I think that maybe people aren't holding themselves as accountable to remaining within their scope of competence or really learning about these things before getting too hyped up or jumping into the hype, I should say.
That's totally a bigger point.
Because it
That's the
seems
bigger point.
Like it's got such huge socially valid results, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's totally the point. And that brings us full circle to earlier the discussion. Like, if a sugar pill works, take the fucking sugar pill. But you can't claim that it's necessarily empirically valid. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's the whole point.
Go like, where the reinforcement flows.
Yeah, man. So I don't know. Like, it is what it is there. But if we're having a conversation about philosophy, like, that's a totally different animal. So thank you, yeah. Baum and Moore, for the robust discussions. If only we can
and
encourage.
Please, like, leave your comments about these articles because they're quite interesting. They're long. They're 8 to 11 pages or something like that of diving deeper into Moore's book and then subsequently diving into each other's reviews of reviews.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Pretty awesome. All right, man. First episode back in a while. I feel good about it. This is fun.
Technology high five.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, thank you guys. This was your controversial exchange. Catch you next time. Later.
Bye.
Hey, friend, before you go, please just do us one small thing. Tell a friend, tag somebody, share this with another colleague in behavior analysis. That is the best way you can help us grow. Remember, you can call in on the Anchor app, anchor.fm/thecontroversialexchange. We can actually hear you, reply to that, include them in future episodes. So that is the easiest way to get your voice heard. If you'd like it to be anonymous, just state so when you submit it, and we can make sure that it is completely anonymous as well. Now, another way that you can really help this podcast grow is leaving us a review in iTunes, specifically on the podcasting app for Apple, and it just helps us reach more people. So whether you enjoyed it or not, please leave us a review. That feedback is helpful. Now, you can find us on social media by searching for The Controversial Exchange. Typically, our handle is Controversial Exchange. However, on Twitter, it is Controversial EX, just because we had to shorten that down a little bit. Now, lastly, there are YouTube videos for every single episode now. We are putting them out there. So please make sure you go check that out, especially if you want to see the visual of like what it is and how we're talking about these sort of things. That will be your place. And one last comment, and that is a quick disclaimer. Now, the views expressed during the Controversial Exchange podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the official policy or position of any other agency, organization, employer, or company. Assumptions made in the analysis are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the authors, and since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to revision, change, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity. This podcast is to educate and inform, provide discussion, and does not constitute professional advice.